Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Psychoanalysis, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. My name is Philip Lance, and I'm a host of the channel. Today, I'm interviewing Giuseppe Civitarese about his book, An Apocryphal Dictionary of Psychoanalysis. Dr. Civitarese lives in Pavia, Italy. He's written many books and published dozens of articles in all the best journals. He's among the most prominent and influential psychoanalytic thinkers, writers, and speakers in the world today. And I think I can say a founding theorist of what is known as the post-Bionian field theory school. I've also, I think, heard it called the Pavia school. So maybe we'll hear more about that. But welcome to the program, Dr. Civitarese.
Hi, Philip. Thank you. Thank you very much for your kind presentation and for giving me this possibility.
Well, thank you, because this was really one of the more delightful books I've read for a while, and quite different, quite an experience. So why don't you maybe tell us, this is different than the books you've written before, and maybe we usually start off by just asking, why did you write this particular book?
Well, Philip, there was not a reason. I mean, it's not that I told myself I'm going to write a different book. It's just that when you work with patients and when you are writing about something else, many very nice things, surprising things can happen. Ideas, little events, and it's a pity. I always thought that it's a pity that they are lost forever. And so in this book, I somehow write very little vignettes, ideas. Very simple things, or sometimes also somehow complicated or sophisticated things, but there is always some passion in it. I mean, the I'm always trying to, in the end, to understand what is at the heart of our job, meaning what makes us human. So I started to take some notes, but not absolutely in a systematic way, here and then, from time to time, without any pressure. But I have to say, with some pleasure. And then I thought that I might want to share. And also, I felt somehow a bit more at liberty than when you have to write a classical paper. You have to be very within the rules, coherent, and so on. So I call this, as you say, also when I tell some colleagues, it should be. Give you some fun. I think of it as a funny, but on the other end, it's not funny at all. It is very, very serious because there is always behind some some very serious idea. I think that many entries, I hope that there is a bit of originality. I imagine, I always imagine that some colleagues might start from this and maybe they could write something longer, starting from this small ideas. Now, yes, that was more or less the start of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's a kind of a dictionary. So we have another psychoanalytic dictionary, kind of, with these series of short entries, alphabetical order. But you call it an apocryphal dictionary. Can you tell us why that word is?
Well,
is in
first of all, I have to say that the original title, the title in Italian, it's not an apocryphal dictionary, even if it was also one of the possible titles in Italian, but it is Transpositions, which is quite different, more poetical, more philosophical also. There is a nice sentence by Nietzsche, where he says that we should be able to transpose things into other things. But that did not work. It seems that it doesn't work as a title in English. And so it became, but it's okay, an apocryphal dictionary. So apocryphal, why? Because, of course, as you see, I do not follow the list of all the classical entries that you can find in the La Planche-Pontalis, in the beautiful, one of the last beautiful dictionaries that were published is Claude Legain. Very classical, but very good dictionary. Unfortunately, it is only in French for now, and several others. So this is one reason. Another reason is also that, of course, speaking from the point of view of the, as you said, the post-Bionian field theory, I challenge many classical and achieved ideas. In a way, also that I try to explain myself, but sometimes there are colleagues that feel some frustration because they are not familiar, acquainted with them. But I think that psychoanalysis, we should keep psychoanalysis alive, and somehow the discourse about the unconscious should always be somehow subversive, as it was at the start with Freud. So that's why apocryphal, not official, not very, very personal somehow, very free.
Yeah, and maybe I was thinking, since in some of your writings you talk about a paradigm shift and the new words and vocabulary and concepts that come with new paradigms. In some ways, could we see this as an introduction to a new vocabulary of somewhat new vocabulary of psychoanalysis?
Well, of course. I mean, our vocabulary always changes. No, if you go from Freud to Melanie Klein, it changes, and then Winnicott gives us other ideas and other concepts, and so on. So this is. We need to every time to get new words because the old words somehow become I don't know how to say it in English
worn out.
Let's say, yes, something like that. Also, become many concepts become. Somehow stereotypes. No, they lose their impact. They are forced, and also because epistemology changes, the world in which we live changes, and so. So with Bion, there is a big change, kind of a revolution. It's around 1962, It was the same time in which Winnicott said that there is not such a thing as a baby. No? So I'd call the big shift, the big change of paradigm, going from a Cartesian view, to which still somehow Freud's holds on, to a radical, real, intersubjective point of view, meaning the idea that really to make a mind, so to say, another mind is needed, and we need to study what the qualities of this other mind should be. There is, and as you know, with Bion, we have a different concept. Actualization of the unconscious, of affect, of dream. So it is really a big change. So when you speak with colleagues, and if we don't share these basic postulates, or at least if we do not know that they are there, then it's very difficult to talk.
Well, I thought maybe a good way to give people a flavor of this book would be to start reading some of the entries. So people can kind of see what's in it. So I thought I'd start with, I found there's an entry called Questions, and your entry says, while holding seminars and conferences around the world, I realized that often the questions that irritate are the most useful ones because they are either naive or provocative. Such questions puzzle and push you to think, or rather to slowly digest the little emotional catastrophe that they sometimes produced. One should always be grateful to those who have the courage to ask them. So I thought I'd start with that entry because it occurred to me, oh, maybe some of my questions are going to be naive or provocative, but really more to sort of focus on that little emotional catastrophes. Because in a way, reading through this book, what the reader gets a series of different kinds of emotional catastrophes. And I think that's a Bionian kind of idea too, the idea of emotional shocks, confrontations. Am I right about that?
Yes, Philip, I share your view. My understanding of the concept of a catastrophe in Bion is that it does have necessarily a negative meaning. No, it's like a state of crisis. Somehow to change, you need to go through a state of crisis. It's not there is no guarantee that you that you will get out of it in a positive way. But somehow, no, in Bion's conceptualization of the concept of catastrophe, there is this possibility of change. So yes, I experienced many times how somehow irritating some questions can be, but also I felt that my own ideas, even if expressed with a lot of sincerity and passion and real wish to be and effort to be understood, could sound irritating for other people that again were not familiar with them. So I have to say that even if at the moment maybe it's difficult to contain the emotional, the a catastrophe or little emotional catastrophe, with time you go again on it, and you tell yourself, okay, you should be clearer on this, you should explain better, you should understand better what you want to say. And I just give you an example before you asked this question. When I said, now for example, every time to make it clear that when we speak about Bion and a different understanding, for example, of dreaming, where dreaming becomes kind of a synonym of thinking, Again, we should keep in mind that we are starting from different basic postulates. So not anymore, for example, the unconscious somehow as a hell, which was Freud's idea, again in 1938 or something like that. So even the idea that is something that is encapsulated somehow in a subject, but as Bion says, the unconscious as a psychoanalytic function of personality, meaning kind of an apparatus for thinking and symbol and for symbolization, and then also in transformation, he defined the unconscious as infinity. And we could go on. What kind of infinity does he have in mind? Is that linked to language? As I think, we go around Lacan somehow, etc. One of the entries in the book is about one of those little catastrophes. I was in Vienna, and when I said at the start that Bion in his paper, A Theory of Mind, says that he doesn't like somehow, it's not convincing to him, this distinction, Freudian distinction between primary and secondary process. A colleague from the place got very, very angry with me, and somehow I couldn't read my paper because we engaged in a very difficult difficult conversation. And then during the pause, he came to me and said, "Well, you know, Giuseppe, here in Vienna, we are very attached to our Freud." So we, in the end, we smiled, next meeting was much more went much, much better.
Well, I had a few little moments when I was irritated. There's some entries I never quite could get my head around, but so many of the entries moved me in more positive ways, very emotionally. And I had to read the book very slowly and just like reading a couple entries. I think this at a time, this might be a good book for an analyst to keep by their chair, you know, when you have a little bit of extra time between clients or something, just to pick it up and dip in, read a couple entries and meditate on them, because they're very often short but quite profound. So that was one of my thoughts about the book. Let me read another entry. This one is called Ambiguity. And then I'm also going to read the entry immediately following. Okay, so the entry Ambiguity. The word ambiguity is mostly used in its negative sense. Yet William Empson's book on the seven types of ambiguity dates back to 1930. In it, ambiguity is defined as the possibility of simultaneously considering alternative views to interpret a text, avoiding pure and simple misunderstandings. But the ability to realize the ambiguity of all things in the world and to tolerate it is exactly what, according to Ogden, analysts strive to promote in their patients. Being able to see things according to the simultaneous multiplicity of angles that is proper to the unconscious makes us feel truer and more real. Then the very next entry is analysis via Skype, seeing yourself on top of the other and the other on top of yourself. So these are the kind of entries that make me laugh because I had to sort of try to think about that one for a while, but I guess on a Skype, the screen is divided into different sections where you can see yourself and the patient. But
yes.
But that entry kind of comments on the one above about ambiguity. So in a way, even though this is a dictionary and you wouldn't expect contiguous entries to necessarily comment on each other, they do at times, very many times in your book. So this could be a book that is read in a more from beginning to end, and there's connections, but it's also a book that you could jump around in.
Well, my idea, Philip, was precisely as you suggested, that my idea is that one should jump from here to there, she could just read one entry, or maybe just select the kind of entries that they like, that they prefer. Maybe there are many short, and I hope also amusing somehow, nice clinical vignette. Or even when there are no vignettes, for example, I discovered this page where Winnicott says, okay, let's read the letters that Freud used to send to his fiancée. And so in the end, we will know if he was human or not. And then he reads all the letters, and in the end, very seriously, he writes, okay, now we know that he was human. So you see, there are many of these entries. So and sometimes also in the more complex one, and I think one can find some pleasure. I never imagined that someone would read it starting from A to Z. This is precisely the kind of book in which you create your own book. You, as my friend Ogden would say, you will write a new book. You will read it and you will write it again for you.
There's one entry called Thread, which is not an entry you would expect to find in a psychoanalytic dictionary. And it goes on for like five pages. It's probably the longest entry in the book. And excellent. It helped me so much with a patient I saw yesterday, actually, because I just read it yesterday. It's followed by an entry, Transference, which is an entry you would expect to find in a psychoanalytic dictionary, but it's only like three lines following five pages of Thread. That's the kind of humorous thing that happens in this book. I find that funny anyway.
By the way, if you read Transference, but also I think that I speak of Transference in an apocryphal way, because I talk about a movie, the Martian, so it's not completely in the classical way. Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Let me read Cinderella. That's an entry in this book. And just to remind the listeners, Cinderella, what, she's wearing rags and scrubbing floors in the basement of her castle. And then I guess she meets, is there a fairy godmother? She transforms into a princess with a beautiful ball gown and glass slippers, goes to the ball, meets the prince. And then when the clock strikes 12, she transforms back into her her ragged self. So I had to, anyway, let me read the entry. Cinderella, if the spectator did not know about the previous metamorphosis, he would think that it is when the carriage turns back into a pumpkin that Cinderella begins to hallucinate. From this, one can see the importance of context. There is no outside text, says Derrida. Okay. Yeah, very short, dense. Can you comment on that?
Well, first of all, you give me also the occasion to say that I like to read to write nice lapsus these entries, even because the aphoristic form gives you the possibility on one side not wanting to say it all. You can be very concise. You just suggest. Then the reader will have to to complete the text, the sentences. At the same time, being short, the small pieces of the text, you have the possibility. Someone that is not a writer, because we mainly our work is with patients to try to work a bit more to try to pay more attention to the quality of writing. By the way, this is precisely the example of an entry where there is a high reference somehow to Derrida, which is quite a sophisticated philosopher, for whom psychoanalysis, by the way, was very, very important at the heart of his thinking. And some readers maybe will like this. But on the other end, there is just a fairy tale. And what is all about? It's about, again, the context. The context is what you were talking before. Now, when you said these entries, I ordered them only according to the alphabetical order. But then when you read them in the page, of course, they interact. Somehow there is this après-coup or avant-coup effect. And so a new text comes out. And this is very much what happens continuously in our clinical practice.
And do you think somebody who doesn't know something about Bion and Bionian field theory, could they come to this book and grasp it? Or do you think it's you need to have some background before you can appreciate it?
Well, I think that it can be read at different levels. No, I think that it can be read by colleagues that do not know anything about Bion, even if nowadays Bion should be part of our common ground, like all the big authors. People that are more acquainted with Bion might recognize things and ideas that otherwise you would not notice. But no, I don't think that, because yes, okay, Bion and field theory, but this is always within the great galaxy of the new paradigm of psychoanalysis. We may say the intersubjective, relational. And so even if somebody is not really knowledgeable with Bion, but still, he will recognize what the meaning is of the adjective in the title, meaning at the apocryphal. Where is why and what is the new or different perspective that I try to give the reader?
Yeah, I'm thinking maybe I read a paper yesterday by Grotstein, who is an author that you referenced. He was a member of the institute that I belong to here in Los Angeles. But he talked about listening with the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere of the mind in one of his papers. And I think if somebody read your book, even if they didn't follow the logic or the rationality because they didn't know enough theory, they could still absorb a lot of the spirit of field theory because of the emotional literary kind of quality of the text that makes an impact on the reader.
I think that you're right. Yeah.
Okay. So let me read something, another sort of amusing entry. that you might not expect to find. It's called Comics. Comics. And when I read your entry on comics, it reminded me of an entry or a passage I read from a teacher of the British Psychoanalytic Society named Ella Sharp. In 1930, she wrote an article about how to train for psychoanalysis. And she said, to prepare for qualification as a psychoanalyst, I would make compulsory the following books. And then she mentions all these English classics from the 19th century mostly, but Brer Rabbit books and Greek myths and tragedies, Shakespeare's plays. I guess that's not 19th century. But and then she said her final examination for a candidate for to become a psychoanalyst would, she would ask them to give briefly the story of the three blind mice. If the mice were blind, how came they to run after the farmer's wife so purposefully? She goes on to talk, to want, you know, us to understand the three blind mice. Anyway, I thought that was so funny when I read that in training. And then I came across your entry in this book, which says, Comics. To get the qualification to practice, an analyst should demonstrate a knowledge of, in order of relevance, at least Calvin and Hobbes, B.C., and the Fusco brothers. After these, you could have Zero Calcare, Dastardly and Muttley, Professor Balthazar, and Colt. At one point or another, they all come in handy in my clinical work to talk to the patient in a simple manner and not in a cold or abstract way. So, comics, important for an analyst. Would you like to comment on that? That one made me laugh.
Yes. Well, first of all, I noticed, Philip, that you did not write peanuts, because peanuts in my entry was the first of the list and the most important one. Yes. I don't know what meaning that. We are psychoanalysts after all. But to me, peanuts means not only my infancy, but because I still read it and enjoy it. To me, it's like poetry. So something very, very, very personal, that it is very much in the landscape of my imaginary, so to say, and is a constant reference in many moments in my private life or with patients. It comes to my mind. Colt. Colt, I just read a book so many years ago, I don't even remember who the author is, and it was so funny. There were always those that went to attack the small fort, and the people in the fort all the time say, oh, not today, our flag is at the laundry, come tomorrow. So you see, the important thing is that, or I give an example, there is an entry, medal that is inspired to Dastardly and Muttley. So I think that the important thing is that you, when the context again is appropriate, of course, you play with the patient. You try to reformulate what the problem is with metaphors. A metaphor is like a little portable dream that you give. Now you can always go back to a metaphor, and always you find something new. It's much better than any kind of rational, smart explanations. I did read some years ago Ella Sharp's book on the theory of dreams, and I liked her very much, because I think that we share this idea that somehow poetry is important, that poetry is so close to dreaming and vice versa. I did not know the text that you quote, because otherwise maybe I would have mentioned it. I noticed comparing it with mice that somehow they are more dramatic. This mice being killed, cutting the tails. Maybe, I don't know, a bit lighter, but it's good. I like very much Ella Sharp's, and about myths and tragedies and Shakespeare, of course. Last week, I spent a couple of sessions talking with a patient of mine about the figure of Calypso. I don't know, it is in English, in Ulysses, by Homer and the differences with Penelope and Circe. But of course, we were negotiating our own analytic field, our own relationship, no? through these narratives. Another last meaning that what is important to me, why did I write this? Because an important message between the lines is that I don't like any kind of rigidity or of bigotry. And we have to say that there is some, more than some, in our psychoanalytic institutions. No? This idea of somehow superiority or being authoritative, like the ones that seem to know that what the truth is, or they very easily come to a kind of pedagogical attitude with patients. This is not my stuff.
Yeah, well, I think it shows us something too about how Ella Sharp was kind of referencing these English classics, the canon, to kind of play off of the canonical literature versus the apocryphal literature, whereas you're sticking with a more popular level of literature, these comics. And in fact, throughout the book, there's so many references to popular literature and films and novels and art exhibitions and museums. It just goes on and on. And I thought that connected to the idea of the infinite and beyond, that wherever you are, whichever culture, you can draw from that culture, all parts of the world, to bring it to work with our clients. You said too in one entry something about you should speak to your clients like you're talking to a friend in a bar. I think that was in this book, unless I'm...
Yes.
I really liked that. So I've tried to do that more recently, just use that simple language. Let me, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Yeah.
Okay, I was going to say, well, I'll read another entry. This one, field one. I guess you actually have three different entries on field. This is the first one. In psychoanalysis, it indicates a multidimensional spatiality that is created between patient and analyst as the intersection of the respective bundles of projective identification. It is a virtual or a fictional space. Attracted in the game of its forces, any object is transformed into an unknown or in a preconception and acquires the character of a dream element. The field concept serves to intensify not only abstract or intellectual knowledge, but experiential knowledge of the facts of analysis. As a dream, the analytic field is a place where the body is given back to the mind and where the mind can resettle in the body. So that's an example of an entry that I spent a good amount of time sort of thinking about and feeling into. Do you want to comment on that one?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's nice that you gave an idea to the people who are listening us of what a very different kind of entry can be if compared with the one about comics. So, yes, this is something that I'm told from time to time, that sometimes I write with a style that it's a bit difficult, dense. Yes, and I keep trying to do better, but sometimes I say, okay, this is how I am. On one side, they can be very, very simple and bar talking, and sometimes also, we shouldn't think that systematically. Well, there are things that can only be said somehow in a sophisticated way, in a difficult way. Otherwise, we would draw out of the window so many incredibly beautiful books of the last century, for example, in philosophy, but also in psychoanalysis. Anyway, what I want to say about what is field? Field basically is a metaphor. Why is it useful? Because it gives us an idea that, in our opinion, there is always, no matter what is the content of the analytic discourse, there is always active an unconscious communication between a patient and analyst. We cannot stop there. And this unconscious communication, we cannot control it. So it becomes kind of a third mind. That's why the metaphor of the field, it's like a gestalt figure. No? Its functioning is more than the sum of the single elements that constitute it. So we need to try to catch this radically intersubjective unconscious dimension. This is the symmetric moment. So what does it mean? That when you listen to a patient or even to yourself, because you are a place in this field, no matter what is said, but virtually allowing yourself to go from immersion to interaction somehow, from asymmetrical to symmetrical moment while you are listening, but virtually everything could be kind of an hologram or a figure or a character, something that is created by this shared unconscious communication. Why is that important? Because under the narratives, there are emotions. So maybe it's easier to try to intuit what is the air that at a certain point patient and analyst are breathing. If it is intoxicated, if it needs to be changed, transformed in some way or not. Another point is that it is every time the analyst rediscovers somehow, no, Flaubert, like Flaubert said, Madame Bovary, c'est moi, meaning that he is always somehow deeply, unconsciously participating in determining what the so-called facts of the analysis are. And this much more easily, I think, allows the analyst to try to understand, not only intellectually, but also with his or her own body, with emotions. Why? Because you are there, because you are directly concerned. So there are a lot of people that object to us that we neglect the reality of the trauma, the subjectivity, and the story of the patient. This is absurd to my eyes, because first of all, real trauma is not the narrative about trauma in the session. Secondly, because mostly this is an understanding that remains in the analyst's mind. With the patient, you talk and you should humanly about what the facts of his or her story are. And the third point is that people that move this objection, they should explain why certain things they interpret as pertaining to the unconscious communication and something remain completely stuck to reality. My fear is that all this talk that is so common nowadays on trauma in psychoanalysis is pushing us before Freud, because we know that Freud started with a critique of the idea of factual trauma. But we should differentiate. The trauma is one thing, but the point is in the session, when we are thinking about reality or concrete facts, why now? What is the unconscious meaning? So field theory is very much Freudian in this respect, because really we put at the center of it in a radical way what? The unconscious and dreaming. So there is nothing more Freudian or psychoanalytic than that.
Yeah, thank you. That was a really lovely kind of little mini discourse on field theory and how it begins to impact how we work with patients. I want to read another very short entry called Intermediarity, which is a word I'd never come across in my psychoanalytic reading, but now it's in the dictionary, intermediarity. Psychoanalysis belongs to the intermediate world. This essential truth is expressed in various concepts: transference, Freud; transitional space, Winnicott; something between, Bion; the intersubjective analytic third, Ogden; the analytic field, Farrow. I just thought it was nice how you linked all those major psychoanalytic writers, and they're all dealing with the intermediate. And yeah, very nice.
Well, I think that in the end, all those concepts try to understand what the unconscious and the psychic reality, and the meeting of minds. So they all try to catch to try to understand what is really the core of humanity. What does it mean that we have a mind? But they do this having a different understanding of the unconscious, a different understanding of the process of analysis, a different understanding of the extension, as I just said before, of this unconscious communication that is going on all the time during the analytic during the analytic session. I don't know if that is clear enough, Philip, but.
Yeah, I thought that was a helpful entry and just kind of feeling into something we're doing that's common to all the different schools. And
Yes, I also try to find somehow a common ground. No?
Yeah, we're nearing the end of our time. And so I'm not going to read a couple other entries I wanted to read, but maybe I'll just finish with a couple questions and you can respond to them, which are, what was your process in putting this together? Do you carry around a little spiral notebook and you were making kind of notes and ideas when something came to mind? And then also, is there anything else you want to say about this book before we wrap up?
The first question, yes, I keep a notebook on my table. So as you suggested before, maybe during a pause between a patient and another patient, but also sometimes while I am reading or writing something and an idea that does not fit in the main frame at the moment, that is marginal but intriguing, I just put it down, and then from time to time, then I put it in a file on my Mac. So very much, it's a notebook work. By the way, I like a few of them very much. So even there is also this part of some aesthetics, so to say. There is a beautiful German notebook which is called Notizbuch, Bindwerk Notizbuch, that I love. Or there are the notebook from the Midori house from Japan that are beautiful. This is to mean to say that I also like this part of writing. I mean, all the tricky things that you can find in a stationery shop and so on. About the book, I don't know what to say. Just a hope. I'd hope that people who read it, I hope that some of them will read it, find it alive, that they find the trace of a great love for psychoanalysis and a great passion, and this how gratifying it can be. This is also something that I'm trying to transmit, how gratifying it can be to to allow yourself this some wild thoughts and to practice this exercise of transpositions, which is not something that you decide to do, but it has more to do with being receptive to idea that can flow at a certain point in your mind.
Well, thank you very much for this book that I think a lot of people are going to really enjoy reading and is going to enrich their thinking and practice as a psychoanalyst. And thank you for this interview too, because I think it's going to be really interesting for people who know your name, but maybe they've never read you or heard you speak. They're going to get a chance to get to know you a little bit through this podcast.
Thank you very much, Philip. Of course, I hope a listener will pardon my pronunciation, which is, of course, an Italian English. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. So you've been listening to an interview with Giuseppe Civitarese about his book, An Apocryphal Dictionary of Psychoanalysis, here at the New Books in Psychoanalysis channel, which is a podcast channel of the New Books Network. Please check out our website, where you can subscribe with your email address and never miss an episode. Thanks for listening.